What I'd like to talk about this afternoon is the conceit of self. It follows on a little bit from yesterday's talk. Now, you probably wouldn't have noticed because you don't see me very often, but those who know me well in different retreat situations sometimes remark on the fact that I have become quite a bower as I age. And they ask me why that is. And, you know, very often in retreat centers that many of you have been in, you know, where there's Buddha statues and, you know, kind of more formal retreat situation. Of course, you know, people are sometimes puzzled by this reality that people seem to be bowing left, right, and center. You know? And many times new students and old students too really do come and ask me what this bowing stuff is all about. And some people tell me they assume it's a kind of ritual reserved for advanced students. Some people tell me they feel very uncomfortable with it, that they came to this tradition in order to get away from religiosity, so to speak, and ritual. And I think there probably are many reasons for bowing. For some people, it's a gesture of respect and appreciation. For some people, it's a kind of offering of gratitude for the lineage of where the teaching comes from. For some people, it's a way of setting a clear intention as they begin a sitting or a walking. And there's probably all kinds of reasons people bow that I really don't know about. But what I'd like to speak about this afternoon is my own long journey to a bow. I began my practice in the Tibetan tradition and culture, which, as probably many of you know, this is a very serious bowing tradition. You know, not just an inclination of the head or hands together, but, you know, the whole full prostration. You know, when I practiced in that tradition, I saw Tibetans going on pilgrimages, you know, and sometimes they would do it for hundreds of miles, doing full prostrations all the way. And, you know, I would see, when I first went into that community, I would see some of the Tibetans, you know, and they had this curious lump on their foreheads, and I wondered, you know, if it was a sort of genetic thing, you know, and then I realized it was a callus. And it was a callus from doing so many full prostrations. And when I began my own training, I remember very clearly going into the hut where my teacher lived for the first time and saw all of these old students prostrating themselves at his feet. And my first response at that time was truly a kind of visceral response before it even entered the level of thought. And it was a major no way, you know? No way. I saw it as a kind of humiliation. I saw it as a kind of subjugation, a kind of self-effacement. And certainly, you know, I had plenty of pride. And I kind of thought, well, you know, here's sitting this old, bald, plump, unsmiling guy, swaddled in these red robes, and why would I lower myself before him? Or, you know, another thought was like, who is he to deserve or to warrant this? And, you know, I would certainly acknowledge at that time I didn't even have the awareness to notice the kind of recurrent themes and emotions that were going through me of I, me, you, him, high, low, better, worse, worthy, unworthy. But what I did know was the whole thing really troubled me. You know, I just couldn't really make peace with it. And I must admit that over the years, in the light of just a little awareness growing through the teaching, I really did feel developing in myself a kind of growing sense of respect, actually, for the depths of wisdom and compassion, and particularly the patience that my teacher brought in teaching the zany group of hippies. Looked like something from another planet to him, you know, no faith, full of argument, you know, the whole shebang. But I did find myself at times inching towards a bow. You know, sometimes it was just a little bob of the head, you know. It was kind of like a token bow, you know. And at times it was a much deeper and heartfelt bow. But there was still a place in me that had a lot of tension around the whole thing. And over the years, I continued to practice in other bowing cultures. You know, in Asia, it's bowing cultures, you know. And I continued to practice in other bowing cultures. And in Thailand, you know, I would see elderly nuns with, like, many years of practice on their knees before young monks in their teens with no practice and almost no wisdom. And I saw the bowing went only one way. And, you know, there I went into this full-blown state of rebellion. You know, I was not going to do this. I was not going to be co-opted into this culture of subservience, where it was kind of an expectation about bowing that had nothing to do, it seemed to me, with the reality of respect. When I went to Korea, I saw another practice environment, you know, where everyone bowed to everyone and everything. You know, the door, the lights, the fence, you know, other people. It was just like always this bowing, and it was with a lot of smiling and a lot of happiness and a lot of giving, which of course immediately sort of like shifted my rebellion to wonder, well, actually, what was going on here? It was like a completely different climate. And I must admit that over the years, I've come to see the bow, not just as a physical gesture, but as an investigation and as an inquiry, as an invitation to deepen an understanding. And for me, the bow has come to be a metaphor that actually represents many aspects of the Dharma. The understanding of pride, of selfing, of discriminating wisdom, of conceit, of self-image. So for me, I must say, the bow is actually no small thing. It's a journey. And by the way, I just want to mention, this talk is most 100% definitely not an encouragement to the non-bowers amongst you to begin bowing. Please be happy in not bowing if you are happy in not bowing. Perhaps the first thing I had to come to understand as an issue to be addressed was to acknowledge, as one of my friends put it, that the bow is not a scrape. The bow is not ever meant to be a scrape. Because I do often feel that resistance comes because we think of bowing as kneeling or humbling ourselves before someone or something more worthy of respect than ourselves. And clearly, over the centuries, you know, a lot of people have really spent too much time scraping. You know, really acting out of that sense of unworthiness or being less than and not good enough. And quite frankly, for some people in this tradition, you know, the journey of renouncing scraping is long and hard. And it's almost a journey of reclaiming a sense of dignity and respect and integrity. And in this tradition, my understanding, there is nowhere in this teaching where we are invited to surrender discriminating wisdom. And that means that we are really invited to understand the difference between a bow and a scrape. And again, culturally, you know, we may not go around physically scraping, but our relationship to authority may be such that we have a tendency to dismiss or to demean our own inner respect. I think we come to see that scraping really does hold fear and self-abandonment, and a true bow doesn't ask for any of this. In fact, a true bow, in my understanding, can be a radical act of love and of freedom. And I go to Suzuki Roshi from the Zen tradition, which I'm sure as you all know is a big, again, it's a big bowing tradition. He said, when everything exists within you, your big mind, all dualistic relationships drop away. There is no distinction between heaven, earth, teacher, and disciple. Sometimes a man bows to a woman, sometimes a woman bows to a man. Sometimes the disciple bows to the master, sometimes the master bows to the disciple. Sometimes the master and disciple bow together to Buddha. Sometimes we may bow to cats and dogs. In your practice, you should accept everything as it is, giving to each thing the same respect as given to a Buddha. Here there is Buddhahood. The Buddha bows to the Buddha, and you bow to yourself. This is the true bow. Now, my long journey to a bow has been and continues to be in many ways a contemplation of what in this teaching is called mana. It's a Pali word which is translated as conceit or the conceit of self. I think it's very important to understand that the way this word conceit or conceit of self is used in this teaching is probably a little different than how we would usually use the word conceit, which is often equated with a kind of, you know, a smugness or, you know, just sense of superiority or, you know, self-aggrandizement in some way. But I feel that in our own lives, we should probably never underestimate the power of the conceit of self and how ingeniously it actually does disguise itself. But really how it has the power to keep us locked into these dualities of self and other, and to separate and to divide. Now, in many ways, one of the maps of awakening that the Buddha taught, he said that the conceit of self, is actually the very last obstacle to be let go of in the journey of full and complete liberation. He said craving, ill will and aversion, fear, doubt, all of these are way easier to let go of than the conceit of self. So in a way you get a sense of the size of the cloth of mana or conceit. So how does mana manifest? In three ways. One is in superiority conceit. The second is in inferiority conceit. And the third is in equality conceit. And in one of the suttas, the Buddha says, one who has truly penetrated this threefold conceit is said to have put an end to suffering. And that within this threefold conceit of being better than, worse than, equal to, is held the whole world of self-view, all the comparing, the evaluating, the measuring that goes on in our lives, the sense of success and failure. striving and despair, that within this threefold conceit are held all the ways that we kind of position ourselves in relationship to others. I'm better than you, I'm worse than you, I'm the same as you. So it holds, too, all the jealousy and envy and resentment and the beliefs in unworthiness that can actually cause so much suffering and pain in our lives. And in truth, in a way, disbars us from depths of compassion and peace and freedom. Now, what mana, or the conceit of self, is, it's describing a way, the ways that we kind of contract around and solidify a sense of self or a sense of other. So I want to look at all these three different forms of conceit. And let's start with superiority conceit. The ways that we can feel better than, smarter than, superior to another. Now, superiority conceit can gather around a lot of things. Our appearance, our bodies. You know, I'm more attractive, I'm slimmer as we get older, it's I'm more toned. You know, I'm... than you. You know, last year I have to tell you a story about this. I mean, I won the rowing competition in my gym. I have to qualify that because it was a rowing competition for women in my age group. However, in winning the rowing competition, the result of that, one of the results, I mean, I felt quite pleased, you know, but one of the results of that, you might ask why I entered a rowing competition, but that's a whole other story. But one of the results was they put this big sign on the gym door, you know, that Christina Feldman is the winner of the rowing competition. And it stayed there for a week. I live in a small town, you know, so, you know, every time I went to the gym and I saw this sign, I just felt so embarrassed. And I said, well, what is that about? What is that about? You know, I mean, why not? You know, sign on the gym door, big deal, you know. I actually realized it was a kind of conceit. Like, I didn't want to be visible in that way, you know, as the super rower. You know, I've done a teacher, you know, a super rower, you know. I realized there was something about just not really wanting to be visible in that way. Superiority conceit can gather around our intellect, you know, around our minds, you know, like I'm really smart, you know, I'm really a very smart person, certainly smarter than you. It can gather around our meditation. You know, we can sit in the hall and, you know, perhaps a person beside us, you know, is a shuffler and restless or a snorer. And, you know, you can hear that little, you can hear that little voice that comes up and says, I would never do that. You know, I'm a much better, you know, a much more advanced meditator than them. Or even the way that we kind of may rehearse for an interview. You know, that we can be very selective in what we bring to an interview group. Am I going to report my worst experience of the day? Sometimes, maybe. But how, so for some people, where their superiority conceit is more in the ascendancy, it's let me choose the thing that's actually going to make me look good. You know, going to make me appear like I'm doing pretty well. When we see someone acting out, we tell ourselves, I would never do that. You know, maybe we're the ones who stay long after the bell is rung, just hoping maybe somebody might notice. And sometimes with superiority conceit, we become the most enthusiastic bowers. You know, I'm so humble. I'm so humble. Now, sometimes, you know, superiority conceit, of course, is very easy to recognize, especially in others, I might say. when it manifests in arrogance or bragging, you know, or this kind of imposing of our importance or excellence on the world, name dropping. But it can also be so subtle. You know, I know like when my children were very small, you know, one of their mantras was always, look at me, look at me, look at me. And of course, as we grow older, we're not actually shouting that any longer. But we can be doing it very kind of subtly. You know, look at me, look at me. Infatuated a little bit with ourselves sometimes. Sometimes superiority can even manifest as a kind of false modesty. You know, there's a story of this very kind of famous rabbi, you know, and he was on his deathbed, and when he was dying, you know, all these people came to visit him to pay their last respects, and they would stand beside his deathbed and kind of extol his virtues. You know, he was so erudite, he was so eloquent, you know, he was so learned, you know, he was so virtuous, he was so kind. And after they left, his wife noticed he was kind of restless in his bed, and she said, but you know, what's wrong? You know, haven't you heard all the praise and appreciation that's been brought? And he said, yes, but nobody mentioned my humility. I mean, it's interesting. Sometimes we only know superiority conceit by this kind of lurking fear of loss or the fear of blame. The fear of judgment. But always, I think it's important to see how superiority conceit solidifies in us in such a way that it's very difficult to learn. It's very difficult to learn from another. It's very difficult even to learn from life. Because we're always in this position of having to maintain this position of, I know. You know, I know. You know, you don't need to tell me. I actually know. Now, superiority conceit superficially looks more attractive than inferiority conceit. But in truth, they both cause the same suffering. And one of the things that superiority conceit does is that it distorts compassion into the kind of near enemy of pity. You know, I feel sorry for you. But at the same time, there's this kind of distancing and looking down upon. Superiority conceit, we often leave a very big footprint in the world. We get locked into better and worse. We get preoccupied with praise and blame. And often in that being locked into superiority conceit, we are in truth very far from a bow. But the other side of mana, you might say the other extreme, is inferiority conceit. And for many people, this is perhaps more familiar territory. Feeling less than, worse than, inferior to, lower than. The difficulty in actually challenging things we feel to be untrue or unacceptable. The kind of chronic sense more of unworthiness that is in truth so endemic in our culture. I think in the torment, the painfulness of inferiority conceit, we can look with a certain envy at those who seem to inhabit this seemingly better world of superiority conceit because they look invulnerable. And we imagine, of course, that they are much happier than we are. And we almost see that the remedy for inferiority conceit is to somehow become like those who walk around the world with such assurance and confidence, or, you know, we can also experience a lot of envy. But what we do see is that this sense of envy and resentment and feelings of lack go round and round in one of those vicious circles. And at times it's so subtle. And to me, it's very obvious, I have to say, that much of our economy actually survives upon this inferiority conceit, the sense of lack, of deficiency, of not enough, of not being good enough, of not having enough. You know, and so really the ability to sell empty promises. You know, I mean, I'm sure you've seen the ads on TV. You know, you just need this to be happy. You know, this new car, this new wrinkle remover, you know, this new this, that, and the other. They're empty promises that really perpetuate the sense of lack. Often that kind of endemic chronic craving is the outcome of inferiority conceit, that I actually never have enough or I'm good enough. And it's kind of the opposite of the enlightened mind that suggests that there is nothing in this moment that is lacking. Inferiority conceit is also very clearly the forerunner of scraping. You know, creating heroes and heroines that occupy a landscape that actually seems impossible for us. It can also be much more subtle. You know, inferiority conceit really plays itself out in the practice, where we can believe that liberation is impossible for us. And one of the symptoms of inferiority conceit to me is that there's a great deal of difficulty in holding goals and aspirations skillfully. That we know how to bow to others, but may have a great deal of difficulty in bowing to ourselves. And for some people, learning to bow to themselves is one of the steps in realizing that a bow is just a bow, where all the ideas of self and other and worthy and unworthy really fall away. Now, I notice in teaching that many, many people in the West have a real allergy to goals. I notice that people have a real allergy to goals, even to aspirations. And I think one of the reasons is that when people look at their past and that kind of life of striving or trying to achieve and disappointment, where goals have been very much surrounded by ambition and forcing, there comes to be this belief that having goals makes us suffer. And, you know, sometimes people even say to me, you know, well, I don't have any goals in my practice. And find it very hard to say with any sincerity, you know, that I really practice to know the same freedom as the Buddha knew. You know, that I practice to realize the same compassion, the same liberation as Buddhas through time. And I think one of the really important steps in this path, because this path is saturated with goals, let's get real. You know, when we talk about anything that's not actually present, when we talk about peace, about happiness, about calm, about concentration, about liberation, when we're talking about actually anything that's not present right now, it is in truth a goal. It's an aspiration. I mean, this path actually has outcomes and is meant to have outcomes. We don't do this to stay the same, believe it or not. You know, we actually do this because there are fruitions, there are outcomes of the practice that are very realizable for everyone who practices. But I think one of the steps in really being able to hold those aspirations skillfully is to see that it was never goals in themselves that caused us to suffer. It was the conceit of self, tying itself to goals, that caused us to suffer. It was a conceit of self that leads to the feelings of failure, of inability, of unworthiness, that just got tied to certain aspirations. And to surrender aspiration is actually in a way to surrender the path. You know, because this path actually really relies upon us having aspirations that we truly trust as being realizable, not just as fantasies for others. And I think in truth we learn to get very comfortable with goals. And part of that is, first of all, to see, and second, to understand, and third, to liberate ourselves from the conceit of self, inferiority conceit, and superiority conceit. To really practice to be liberated, to practice because it seems impossible, to practice in order to reclaim that sense of possibility. And in each moment, actually, what we're really learning to do is we're learning to bow. We're learning to bow to that sense of possibility. We're learning to bow to that sense of aspiration. You know, in the last few years, I've been teaching a number of retreats for professionals who are using, like, mindfulness-based applications in their work. And one of the themes that constantly comes up is people say, I feel like a fraud. I feel like I'm not good enough to do this work. So I'm sure maybe when people say that, they expect us to shower reassurance and say, of course you're good enough to do this work. Actually, we say none of us are good enough to do this work. You know, when I'm a Buddha, I'll be good enough to do this work. Meanwhile, not to see that in a negative way, but to how to turn that into an acknowledgement that we have a way to go, but we are going. We are going. And when we arrive, that's the moment we don't even need to say, I'm not good enough to do this work. Because that is actually just another expression of inferiority conceit. Laying down inferiority conceit does not leave a vacuum behind it. What it does, it really releases our capacity for mudita, for appreciation, for appreciative joy, for our capacity to actually celebrate our efforts, our sincerity, our perseverance, our willingness to show up, to actually celebrate the good fortune, the blessings of ourselves and of others. I mean, sometimes when we see the suffering involved in superiority conceit or inferiority conceit, we can think that equality conceit is the middle path. But it's not. Equality conceit, which is, it's hard to think of equality conceit, isn't it? What does that mean, equality conceit? It's a conceit of reductionism, where we look at the world around us and we look at ourselves and we come to this conclusion, actually, we're all schmucks swimming in the same sea of delusion, you know? We're all in ignorance together, you know? We're all greedy. We're all confused. We're all, you know, we're all the same. We're all suffering. And we can see actually a kind of comfort or reassurance in that generalization of suffering. But this is a kind of reductionism, actually, where all that we're doing is we're seeing our own delusions reflected in the lives and hearts of others, but then the tendency to be always looking for the faults and the imperfect in our heroes, in our heroines. And then we say, I'm not so bad after all. Look, that person thought they were so great, and look, they do that. You know? Well, that person thought they were so special, and I really see what they're like, you know? It's this constant process of really of reductionism, of trying to focus on that which is imperfect. And to me, it's a kind of disillusionment with human possibility. And what it leads to is a kind of cynicism, or even a bitterness. You know, I noticed that when Al Gore got awarded, you know, for his documentary and that Inconvenient Truth, the very next day, I was in Massachusetts at the time. And the very next day, the newspaper printed this article on how much electricity his house used. It was like he wasn't allowed to actually be doing something noble. You know, it was like, let's immediately shoot this down. They didn't, you know, print that he got his electricity from solar panels and he was actually trying to live what he was speaking about. But there was immediately like, no, no. You know, this actually makes us look bad, so we'll make him look bad. You know, this kind of cynicism, this undermining of really things that are noble and how it can lead to a kind of helplessness or even a bitterness. I want to look at just an example of how these three kinds of conceit might play out. And I'm going back to the snoring example. The falling asleep in meditation example. Suppose that I fell off my cushion, overwhelmed by dullness. Now, if I was locked in superiority conceit, I would feel mortified. You know, my self-image would be dented. If I was locked in inferiority conceit, I probably actually wouldn't be here. But if I was here, I would disguise it very well, and I would tell you that this was a teaching. But I would still be devastated. And now everyone knows, huh? If I was locked in equality conceit, I would say, don't expect anything else. You know, we're all dull. You know, this is what happens. It never changes. Now, what would happen if you were locked in those threefold conceit and I fell off my cushion again? If you were locked in inferiority conceit, you might feel so disappointed in me. You would say, oh, she's supposed to be beyond this. You know, there's no hope. If you were locked in superiority conceit, you might feel a little smug. Look, you know, look at her. You know, the teacher, you know, she's falling asleep. I'm awake. If you were locked in equality conceit, you might feel a little consoled. Oh, good, you know. Just like me, you know, falls asleep, you know, we're all the same. You notice that what conceit does, it leads to a lot of storytelling about self and other. It leads to a lot of image building, a lot of image creating and affirming about self and other. Now, of course, we turn exactly the same scenario around. And you fall off your cushion, and how those three conceits play out. If you're locked in inferiority conceit, quite frankly, the suffering might play out for hours. You know, you could bring in years of history. You know, I failed at everything, nothing I've ever tried has ever worked out, you know, I'm so disappointed in myself. You know, you could remember every single incident, you weren't selected for the baseball team, you know, you weren't, you know, everything, you know, comes into being to reaffirm that view. If you were locked into superiority conceit again, you would feel exposed. Equality conceit, you would open your eyes, you know, you would look around, see somebody else nodding off. I knew it. And I'm not the only one. I'm not alone. So what we see in this threefold conceit is actually the process of fixing and solidifying a view of self and other. And this is what our practice is really dedicated to liberating. And I think first it's so important to sensitize ourselves to the process of this fixing and solidifying. I mean, there are some very obvious clues in judgment, in comparison, in striving, in despair, in the self-view statements that arise of I am, you are. It's not so hard to see What's much more challenging is not to become agitated about what we see. Not to become agitated, but to learn to bow to those appearances. Because to see, whenever conceit arises, we can either solidify it with agitation or aversion, and then we suffer, or we can learn to bow, to know what that this is, and to liberate the moment. My own experience is that life in itself, if seen wisely, is truly an ally in offering us the opportunities to let go of the conceit of self. And I'm sure you, all of you at some point, have experienced times when your world falls apart somewhat. You know, the unpredictable happens, illness happens, someone you love dies, there's a great disappointment in your work, where suddenly your whole world of how it is really disrupted and disturbed. Illness and loss and hardship actually does come into all of our lives in ways that we can't always fix, and we can't control it, and we can't make it go away. And one of the things we really experience in those moments in truth is an erosion of the conceit of self, because we just can't do any of those strategies that we would usually rely on. We can't fix it, we can't control it, we can't make it go away. And as painful as those times can be, we can sink into despair and fear. There can also be moments of actually really profound understanding. There was a teacher who was asked, "What is the secret of your happiness and your equanimity?" And he answered, "It is the wholehearted, unreserved cooperation with the unavoidable." The wholehearted, unreserved cooperation with the unavoidable. And my understanding is that the unavoidable is actually life. It's actually life. And that the secret of our happiness and equanimity lies within our willingness to cooperate, have a dialogue with the unavoidable. When Suzuki Roshi speaks of a bow, he actually spoke of it as a way of challenging mana, challenging this conceit of I, the way that we hold ourselves apart and contracted, the ideas of ourself of being better, worse, the same as. It's not a physical gesture. It's really speaking about an attitude of heart, an attitude of mind. There's one place where he wrote, "When you bow, there is no Buddha and there is no you. One complete bow takes place. That is all. That is liberation." We are bowing to what is. You know, a couple of years ago, I was teaching in Cuba, which is a country where truly you really cannot rely upon anything. And everything actually is bound to go wrong, just when you think it might go right. You know, and there's a total mystery to the whole bureaucracy and how things run, especially when you try and work there. And there was a day when everything was going wrong. You know, we'd been called into immigration and told we couldn't teach there, you know, and, you know, there was no water where we were teaching, and we got an invasion of dogs and chickens. And, you know, basically, you name it, everything was just kind of like awry. And I had with me an old student to translate. And I looked at him, and he had this huge smile on his face. And I said, "Eduardo, what on earth are you smiling about? You know, I thought he'd lost his mind, you know, and I finally succumbed to the chaos. What on earth are you so happy about? He says, I finally got it. He says, all these years I've been listening to you say, you cannot count on anything, life is unpredictable, it cannot be fixed in place, you cannot control it. He says, I finally got it. He says, I think this is what it feels like to be liberated. Suzuki Roshi said, we practice, the practice of the vow is as long as our life. It's as long as our life is. Because to bow is to really open our hearts to this moment. It's to learn to let go of the conceit of I, which is what keeps us trying to control and grasp and cling and solidify all things. And in that, learning to soften that a little. I think we can, in truth, begin to hold our world just a little bit more lightly, with a little more compassion. A little lighter, a little more compassion. And really to understand that not all the pain in life, not all the pain in the world can be fixed. But for sure, all the pain in this world can be met with a bow. With the willingness to cooperate in an unrestricted way with the unavoidable. Learning to let go of better than, worse than, the same as, really allows that softening to begin to happen and to really begin to be able to bow to what is. We take just a couple of moments quietly together.